and that he, you know,
reasonably justifiable.
Really reasonably justifiable, but the thing is, he's been looking tired now for over a month.
Yeah, and, I know.
Same phenomenon set in with Cornip the other night at Willie Williams' house. Cornip has been battling the bureaucracy and losing. Just little things like Mr. Souter's "There Are No Exceptions" over at the housing division when Cornip had a clear case of a girl being screwed by housing. He's been battling it and losing, and the battles lost are coloring everybody's view of the current situation. Maybe they're right, you see. Maybe they're absolutely correct about Metzger and Millett coming up with some kind of sellout, but I think there are more troops that can be brought in a later time. I think Miriam's staff, I think other people who were eyewitnesses in the union, can at least get off the innocent kids. Now, you're right, the corollary of that is how about the guilty kids? But in other words, what I guess I'm saying is I think the university has, I think it has the facts and the moral power to be able to stand up to the state and say, every one of the kids that we have indicted turns out to be innocent, the ones who are guilty got away.
It will not do that, though. I do not believe it will do that. That's something, now this is not talking about my assumption.
Okay, fine.
My assumption is that it's not possible for it to do that.
Why? See, I think they have a plausible story.
I don't believe that it's a question of how plausible the story is. When you're dealing with a public that is first of all prone to be enraged about this, and secondly, has received the misinformation that it has.
Yes.
All the plausibility in the world doesn't mean a thing. It's not a rational situation.
All right, this is true. But
I believe
think that
there
they made one.
Some kind. I don't believe it's possible to make it one. Really don't. Now, I do believe that some kind of action will be necessary. Now, what from what you say, it seems that it's going to be possible to point to the right people.
No, I couldn't guarantee that. I said it's not.
I said it
not
seems
beyond
it's going
the
to be
impossible.
Possible.
Yeah. Well,
now my next question is,
I think, look,
how does
way
one facilitate? Let me put it this way. The next question is, obviously, let's put it this way. Obviously, that would be the optimum situation.
Yes, clearly.
Okay.
I don't know that that's the optimum. That isn't really the optimum. The optimum is to find the people who did it.
That's what I said.
Yeah. Okay. Now I was saying,
to the right people.
Okay. Yeah.
How does one facilitate that situation? Is the next question.
Yeah. Well, that's a rough one. I don't know. I let my lead down on this one.
Let me ask things about details that I don't know anything about.
Yeah.
In a committee hearing, either A or B, subcommittee hearing.
Yeah.
Is there any kind at all of right to subpoena witnesses on your behalf? That is, could a student, or could a prosecutor, whichever way you want to look at it, whatever a prosecutor may be, so there isn't one.
Yeah.
Force McNabb to come to the stand and name names.
I put it this way. I don't know what the rule is now, but I think that by the time those committees meet, that will be possible. But then the next thing is, will the students do it? And this was the subject of a large debate last night. Should these committee hearings, university discipline committee hearings be held before the civil charges? And it was pointed out that if the kid is found guilty by the university on evidence presented at the university hearing, that would prejudice his case in civil court, whereas it wouldn't necessarily help him if he's let off by the university. So it might be the smartest thing. A kid's lawyer might tell him to basically let the university do anything they want with him on the basis of the university's evidence and basically present no case. And then go into civil court and be exonerated, and then come back to the university and say, look, you can't kick me out for something that the state found me totally innocent of. So it isn't obvious that the kids
will
subpoena people if they
could. Right. There's no possibility of delaying the university hearings until after the civil hearings.
There doesn't seem to be. I mean, that was the decision last night anyway. It was the people who know about, Morrison and Reef and guys like that didn't feel that that was a likely thing. They felt that the university discipline would go on.
When are the civil hearings scheduled?
I think they are in there for November. It's a while away. So there's a problem there. I think, though, my own feeling, I still keep saying that we just have to get the story out. In other words, I think it would do us a lot of good if we were able to have, I think, eyewitnesses that could simply tell us that all the damage was done by 10 people. If that could be established concretely, both in the civil court and in the university court, why can't I do that? I think I can do. Well, I think McNabb would testify that far. I know Miriam's people will.
Well, fine.
I know some of the black kids will. It seems to me that all observers are pretty much agreed upon that. It's also highly plausible.
That's fine, you know.
The story's good. I think that story, once it's well established, is the basis for letting the majority of the kids off. And I do think the university then is in a defensible position if it doesn't find any guilty people. I may be too optimistic, but what I don't think will happen, maybe they're dumber than I think they are. Maybe they would burn somebody like Stevie Jackson, even if they didn't know he was guilty. Maybe they would burn him for inciting the riot or something like that. It's possible, you know. But I would hope they'd be smarter than that.
All right, now the other aspect of the thing is the PCSA thing tied into it. It's the possibility that people, whoever they may be, will use this or try to use this to force what is essentially an administrative issue, the Millet situation. Try to use this to bring the Millet, Metzger versus mm-hmm. Albert, West, or whatever you want to say, mm-hmm. faction, that kind of thing to a head. Because they're going to use this as a wedge to be applied in that on that grounds. And it seems that that's happening.
Yeah. This bill is all under the category of people like CRJ and SDS using the current situation for their purposes.
No, it's not just CRJ and SDS,
I believe. Now, this is the charge that the administration uses.
See, Bruce is using it.
Yeah.
Bruce Kahn, I mean, you know, it's amazing. You can go in there and begin to talk to him about anything.
Yeah, and immediately ends up with Noah Metzger. Yeah.
It does, but it always winds up with the 500 situation.
Yeah.
And the incident.
Yeah.
Now, I agree that's partly because of his, you know, personal feelings about the thing, but it's also because I really do believe that consciously he feels that this is the issue.
This
is the issue to pin Millet on. This is the issue to stick him with.
And not only is it the issue, it's the time. And this is, you see, I also agree it's the issue, but I don't think it's the time. I think there's plenty of time to pin Millet. It doesn't have to be done before December 25th. It's Christmas, and I thought it'd be nice to let him have a nice Christmas with his little child and clobber him on the first of the year. I think I don't think there's any doubt that there's been a definite massive administrative failure, and that this failure has been in areas that are under the control of Dean of Students Stanton Miller. I think there's no doubt that Stanton Miller personally has contributed to the deterioration of the situation. What we're sitting here talking about right now, we wouldn't be talking about if there were any faith in Millet, okay? In my mind, I agree with Bruce on this, but what I'm saying is that the administration is inclined to make statements like CRJ, SDS, and, as you say, other people, are using the 500 program to get the political goals they have long held within the university. You see, Carnap is on basically the same game, you know, there are things that the university has done. In a way, I'm all for that. I think that we make a mistake if we think of the 500 program and its failures as being somehow rather unique. The failures that were made by the administration are failures that have been routinely made for years, and the house must be clean. But it's all a question of timing. I think, for example, that within these hearings that we're going to be having, some evidence that the university really botched it ought to be introduced. On the other hand, not so much that the state is able to holler or that the people who really want to get the university out there can holler massive mismanagement of the university or something and bring down everybody. I don't think this is too smart. If the university is to have a house cleaning, it ought to be internal, not external. And there's a real danger that if we play the hand, that the university will, you know, they will have a Rafferty type situation.
But
I want to make a point, which is that CRJ and SDS are not, I think, in their own minds, any more than Morrison is, conscious of the fact that they are using this situation for their own long-range political purposes. You see, CRJ, for example, at its Monday meeting, said something about how they would like to raise money for the 500 program, and that they would announce that was what they were going to do in order to get a large crowd out to their first meeting this year. And I said to them, I'm afraid I'm just going to have to be a little bit cynical about this and point out to you that there wouldn't be anything worse from the point of view of the program and the 500 kids than for you to announce a fundraising program and then come up with no money. And yet that is a very likely outcome. Mm-hmm. And I would say if that was the outcome, I would be in a position of having to accuse you of using the hot issue of the 500 program to get out a lot of people for Citizens for Racial Justice. And I went on to point out to them that it isn't obvious that the what's gone wrong with the 500 program has anything to do with, quotes, racial justice, you see. And if they want to do an investigation of the administrative failure here, they ought to reform a committee called Citizens for Administrative Efficiency or something of that sort, because there really aren't racial overtones to the bungling that went on. Now, as I say, in their minds, they don't see themselves as manipulating the situation, and it infuriates them for you to suggest that they're doing that. But I think that is what's happening, that everyone's past interactions with the administration color him so that he wishes to leap into this arena with the 500 kids and fight for the thing he's always wanted, you know.
Now let me ask you about the hypothesis that Peltison is like shifting sides. that Pelleson was formerly a good guy and is now scrapped or is now stopped. In other words, that Alpert is no longer inputting that. Millet and Metzger are essentially influencing Pelleson's decisions. And this is mostly from Morrison, although I sense it from an awful lot of people in an awful lot of ways, in strange ways.
Yeah, but those same people are always talking to each other.
No, I sense it, I think I sense it elsewhere as well.
Well, look,
anyway,
I'll tell you,
it all began, of course, with the decision on Monday night, or
I
Tuesday
know.
Night.
Yeah.
And in which Bruce
referral
feels...
Committee. Yeah.
No, I'm not talking about the referral committee, I'm talking about the decision to send in the cops.
Oh, yes, okay, yeah.
In which Bruce feels, and other people feel as well, that that was essentially a decision that was, you know, arrived at, certainly with the advice of Millet and probably at Millet's insistence.
But see, what Bruce won't admit, what he knows perfectly well but always conveniently forgets, is that it was William Williams that just as well, in fact maybe more, whose advice was not for the Chancellor not to go over and talk to those kids and for the cops to come in. William said his home, and I have a transcript of this somewhere right here, says that his perception of the situation, even as early as 9 o'clock, you see, when a lot of other people still think it was a happy-go-lucky crowd and so on, was that the crowd had gone past the time that they would listen to kind words and that they wanted action now, and that if they were not given money and rooms at that instant, that there would be nothing else that would satisfy them. That was William's perception of the crowd. William's a reasonably perceptive guy. Therefore, he told the Chancellor not to go in at 9. He certainly told him not to go in again later because by that time the mood really was ugly. In fact, Williams added one thing which I had never known before, which was that he first felt uncomfortable in the Union at 2:30. Because apparently 2:30, and this is something that a lot of people have forgotten, there were demands made that the vending machine room be opened. And now I'm piecing this together and I don't even know my sources now. Some of it's Williams and some of it's other places. There were threats that when the vending machine was open, it wasn't obvious what was going to happen, whether they were just going to go in and get food or whether the vending machines are going to get smashed. There was certainly the covert threat that the machines were you know, they wanted the room open and they weren't going to be able to control the people. In fact,
was the room opened?
No, it was not. That's why the cops came in at 3, because that was the deadline given for opening the vending machine room. And apparently the decision was that there was a good chance that there would be further destruction of property if the vending machine were opened, and this now forced their hand. And I would not, now, you know, I'd forgotten this. I heard it at the time, I believe, from someone. I believe it was Millet maybe said this at the meeting.
Wait a minute, you said Williams first felt uncomfortable at
that time? 2:30, right. He had been in the building all night, but he first felt that he was in some physical danger and that property was really in danger at 2:30. Now,
if that's the case, why did he advise the Chancellor not to come in earlier?
He advised the Chancellor not to come in at least twice. One of the times was at 9. I told you why he advised him not to come in then.
Well, because he felt the mood of the crowd was ugly.
No, because he felt that the Chancellor could offer the crowd nothing. That ugly or no, the only thing the crowd was willing to accept, basically, was some kind of instant solution to the problems. And the Chancellor's simple appearance and saying, "I'm with you, we're working on it," would not be sufficient. In fact, William said he felt that if the Chancellor were to do that, then the crowd would feel totally betrayed. Because here's the man, presumably with all the power, who now admits that he can't do anything. That was Williams's feelings, and that was the argument that he made.
Let me ask this: was that the course of action that was suggested to the Chancellor? I mean, it seems to me now, I wasn't here.
Yeah.
But I have always assumed that if the Chancellor appeared, he would not have appeared to tell them, "I'm with you, we're working on it," but who to have, you know, like said, okay, how many people are involved, taken names of the people that want the rooms, you know, sit down. What I assumed was that they would participate in the administration. That was, I assumed, the graceful way out and the logical thing for him to do, not to come and make a speech.
No, see, it was too late for that because basically the administration had already done that, at least formally, on Saturday and Sunday. They had found out the people who were unhappy and they had sat down with them and they had made them
That, of course, doesn't people. Matter.
I know that, but I...
I mean, that's completely right. Irrelevant to the fact that...
Correct.
Is there and doing
it. Yeah, it was Williams... All right, I'll just simply... I don't know.
How so that was never the intent. The intent was... That if the Chancellor came, he would try to...
Bill, I don't know. All I know is that William's perception was if the Chancellor could not solve the problem on the spot, he better not go in there at all. And I don't think that would be interpreted as solving the problem on the spot, simply sitting down taking the names of the complaints.
No.
In the mind of the crowd, he presumably knew all that, see?
No, but, well, that wouldn't be... I haven't really explained what I felt was the appropriate action. That's all right.
All right, why don't you? What was the appropriate action?
Well, if first of all, to come in and find if the crowd is in fact in that situation, okay. If you know, I mean, if the crowd is amenable to being told they're being worked on and why don't you all go home, that's nice. But if they're not amenable,
okay.
not amenable to that, for him to sit down there with the crowd and like take names, call up professors. Look, what's the problem with the housing? Okay, so you call a professor. You know, have you got a room? Or whatever. It doesn't matter what specific action is taken, so long as the people that are, you know, concerned see the chancellor taking specific action, regardless of how silly it may be, specific action with them.
Yeah. But
to remedy the
situation. Bear in mind that
now that might have failed. I grant you know,
okay.
And if
saying,
so, then maybe he's in physical danger. I don't know, but whatever can you say?
Yeah, true. Actually, that wouldn't have been that implausible a thing to do on Tuesday or on Monday night, since presumably he didn't even know about the financial crisis at this point. But in fact, you see, it wouldn't have worked, because had he gone in there, he would have found out about the financial crisis for the first time from the kids inside the union.
Then the thing to do is to call people up and get other people
over
there.
Yeah, but that takes time. You know, I mean, we'll never know whether he did the right thing. Okay.
Right, I understand.
How do we get off on this?
Well, this was because I didn't understand really why Williams. You know, advised him not to come in.
Okay.
Now I understand why he advised him not to come in,
right,
because his intent was
right,
simply to give a pacifying speech.
I'm not sure, but I tried to counter that a minute ago. What I'm saying is, let me just get Williams' words and quote them, because that's the best way to do this. Then you will know the maximum and the minimum that I know. In other words, I won't be trying to tell you what William Williams was thinking. I'll just tell you what he said he was thinking, and the holes are going to have to remain. But it seems to me. It was something like this. Okay. All right. Williams conferred with the group at 10. Well, Williams went to the union at 9 o'clock, and he talked with students, and he wandered, and he went back and conferred with the chancellor and the other people who were assembled on the fourth floor of the student services building at about 10. And he said at that time that the student group looked very rigid, frustrated, and uptight, but they were not asking to talk. They wanted specific action. He felt for the chancellor to get verbally shot down, which he thought was a good likelihood, and to leave them with no hope would be bad. Therefore, he advised against the chancellor going over.
Did he advise any positive action at that point? Did he advise the police to come in?
Oh, no, not police.
Or what?
Well, apparently he then returned at 11 with, at 11, Millett, Smith, Shelley, and Williams went.
Right.
And tried to talk to the kids up in the BSA office, few of them, and then down to the crowd with no luck. And that we have a pretty good idea what they tried to say. It was however, I mean, it is amusing to know what they did try to do. It was all of the order of magnitude of, we'll work on it in the morning, we're sure everything can be worked out in the morning if you'll only go home, and the specific people with specific problems come and tell us what they are. And when Millett made that announcement that who out there is having the problem, please come tell me what it is, and we'll go right to work on it, and we're sure we'll have it solved by morning, the crowd apparently just hooted him down and said, don't you try to split us off and divide us with that kind of crap. We know that once the people come up and talk to you, you're just going to ignore them again. All you really want to do is get rid of us. This was what he got, basically, for an answer. Now, he's not going to be the best guy to say that kind of thing, but if you think about it, JWP isn't the best public speaker in the world either. I don't know. All I'm saying, Bill, and the whole point of this Morrison is not that Millett and Metzger were not the only people who advised the chancellor not to go in there.
Well,
that people
else.
Like William Williams, you know, who I think generally has credibility with Morrison, and other people did. And Morrison, as I say, conveniently
who did advise the chancellor to go in? Did anyone advise him to go
in? I'm not sure that anyone did from the entire administration.
Did anyone?
I don't know.
Do you know whether anybody else took the position that he should not go in? I'm wondering specifically what Albert advised, if anything.
Yes, if anything.
Because Morrison has, of course, the distinct impression from his phone call with Albert at that, whatever it was, 1:30 that night or whenever it was, that Albert was futilely trying to make a lone voice in the wilderness heard and so forth. And that,
well, look, man,
you
and I both know Dean Albert well enough to know that he doesn't go running around making a big case out of hearsay, you know, out of other people's ideas.
No, I know. I know that.
Now, I will say for Albert that I know for a fact that a certain gentleman by the name of Harvey, was in the union at 9 o'clock drinking coffee, and he came up and happened to see that crowd as he left. This was at 9, and he thought that there was some activity going on as a part of New Student Week, that the crowd was happy and apparently in a festive air, and he felt that it was all very lovely and sweet as he went by it at 9 o'clock. Now, the crowd had many fronts. It's a lot of people. At the same time, William Williams was running into some very uptight types, and we know that 20 minutes before that, there had already been some assaults on white students. The problem is that the crowd is not a monolith, but that when you get talking to the crowd, it only takes three or four people to shout you down, make a fool of you, and basically turn the crowd around.
Yeah.
Makes it more fun, anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, I have made my point, which is that Morrison is making a case here that isn't really there. I think there are lots of good reasons why the Chancellor shouldn't have gone into the Union Monday night, and that it was not only Millett and Metzger who were arguing these reasons.
Okay, then you don't feel, to go back to the main thing, you do not feel that the Chancellor has been swung to a hard line.
No, I don't. I don't think that's true.
And you don't feel that the Chancellor is no longer listening to Albert, and you don't feel that the schism in the administration that is being fictionally proposed.
Any of these things is possible, but I think they're based upon the absolute slimmest of evidence, you see, because Morrison is rereading everything that happened in the worst light.
And you don't believe that the Chancellor is being put into the position of either has been or will be put into the position of having to back Millett, whereas previously his inclinations, if any, were perhaps to get rid of him at some opportunity. Or perhaps, I don't even know if that's true, but there were certainly rumors to that effect.
All of this is just utter speculation.
Okay.
Utter speculation. I mean, even the business about the Chancellor wanting to get rid of Millett is a story that Goss carried back from somewhere.
No, I didn't hear it from Goss. I don't
know. I
hear
know
it
you
anywhere.
Did. This is the problem. I know that it started with Goss because it started in April.
No, I don't hear it. I don't hear it from anywhere like that. The only reason I say that is because it seems to me that if the Chancellor has been in the past and presumably still is as much in tune with student faculty sentiment.
Yeah.
I mean, he must have been aware that this is something that should be seriously considered.
Oh, yes.
And I mean, that's all I mean by saying...
I can assure you that
I'm
know
sure he
that he is aware of these things.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's all I mean.
The anti-Millett case has been, I know for a fact, presented very directly to the Chancellor.
Yeah, I know that. But what I mean is that the feeling now is that he has been somehow either pushed or led or one way or another into a position now where he must back him.
I see not a shred of evidence for that.
Okay,
I don't. The only way you can get that is by replaying the whole tape of the last week and coming up with some kind of a situation, as we just went through, where apparently the Chancellor has always been under Millett's thumb. But I say it's... I tell you, Morrison's hung up on that Monday.
I know, I understand. No, I understand all that.
Yeah,
I'm not.
It colors everything just so much, and he doesn't even realize that himself. He is sure that the Chancellor made a bad decision Monday night, and he is sure that it was based upon Millett and Metzger's testimony, and neither of those things is true. The Chancellor did not necessarily make a bad decision last Monday night, I think. This is, I hope, a reasonably objective position. And he did not make it solely upon the advice of people that Morrison has no faith in. I mean, we know that William Williams made this recommendation on what I would take to be at least reasonable grounds. He may have been wrong, but nothing sinister in the way that decision was made.
No.
And there's nothing sinister in the way that Morrison was kept from the Chancellor.
Well, the only thing sinister about it was
Albert. You don't know what Albert said, but Albert is not the kind of guy that goes around making strong statements based upon evidence that he doesn't have.
I know, but
and for all that Bruce may think, that he communicated to Albert and West sure he was that the Chancellor should come in. It is not obvious that West and Albert would have passed that much urgency on to the Chancellor. I'm sure that it was introduced as one person's assessment of the situation. And I would suggest that, considering where Morrison was most of the time, that his assessment really wasn't any better in the long run than that of Willie Williams or Joe Smith.
Where was he most of the time?
In his office, on the telephone.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell. He says somewhere that he's dictated a pretty good account of where he was all night, and I would like to hear it because I never have.
He has. It's on a dictaphone.
Yeah, good, because that would help a lot. But my impression is that he may have talked to a lot of people. But look, Morrison, I know for a fact he spent a lot of time with Joe Williams. Well, Joe Williams, for heaven's sakes, is, a sweet guy, a great guy. He wasn't talking to Stevie Jackson. He wasn't talking to people who... Nobody really saw everything that was happening there, and we will never know what the crowd might have done under certain conditions. But it seems to me that, to take the crowd as a homogeneous mass is a mistake. It obviously had its nasty elements and it had its perfectly innocent elements. And there were a lot of people in between.
Right, right.
I'm not
arguing that.
I know we're not. But I'm saying that all this is very important because it does color Morrison's view of Metzger and Millett ever since, and it does color his view of the way the Chancellor behaved and on what grounds. He thinks, it's the truth that the Chancellor has constant bad advice from a few real rats. To me, it's the truth that the Chancellor has had some bad advice and some and a good deal of whitewashing from some people who are rats. This is not the same thing. I'm also very aware of a number of other actors in this field who are not as powerless as Morrison makes them out to be.
For example,
Miriam Sheldon, her staff, and Dean Albert, and people like that. And the Chancellor himself is not that much of a dope, you know.
No, I know. That's one of the great
things. And he's also not that much of a political tool, and he's not going to give it to the state. If he gave it to the state, he wouldn't have the 500 program in the first place.
Right. One thing that I don't understand is why, surely everybody is aware by now that Morrison and maybe Wellreef and several other people are beginning to subscribe to this conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Now, why does not somebody tell them what happened that night?
All right. There are two things wrong with that. One, I'm not sure that they do know that these people are subscribing to that theory. Yes,
well,
it is true that Williams knows it now because he was told that Thursday night. On the other hand, Williams spent all day Friday out of town.
Yeah.
This is only Saturday now. There's not been a whole lot of time.
Okay.
Dan Perino shit his pants basically Thursday night and went off. But, you know, Dan, for all that he's been warned against Millett, simply can't believe it. And so his reaction to everything he heard Thursday night was to go to Stan and say, "Stan, everybody's sweating.
Friday noon meeting.
Friday noon meeting. Well, that's just not very productive. It could have worked, you see, but it didn't. It was a kind of a long shot.
Has the Chancellor sat down with these people and talked to them?
Yes, yesterday, I'm told. This is what bothers me. Why
yesterday?
Yes.
Friday?
Yes.
At noon?
Wait a minute, hold on. No, he appeared very briefly yesterday.
He didn't do anything.
Yes, he did. He showed up at that meeting.
Yeah, but
he didn't do anything that helped
the situation.
But, you know, he agreed to meet with anybody who wanted to meet with him on Saturday, and no one ever implemented that. Morrison didn't call him back. Nobody ever implemented it.
There was a reason. It's kind of a reason for that. Now, I think because when he left, he was sort of like, he left it in the hands of Stan to set up or something like that. I believe that's right.
I had the impression last night with Morrison at 8:30 that if Morrison had wanted, he could call the Chancellor and they would have a meeting this morning. But Morrison was super uptight last night, really, and super panicked because he was sure he was going to go up and be talking to Addison and Berkey, and that Addison and Berkey were going to want to have a demonstration, and that he was going to be inclined to say that demonstrations would be counterproductive, but that he wouldn't be able to offer any grounds because he would basically share
the assumptions.
That his only disagreement would be over whether or not the rally was the sensible action to take. And he felt in a very vulnerable position. He was very uptight about it. You know, and he wouldn't stop shouting, basically. You know, what he said to you was in that driving of the finger way he's got. This morning he seemed much more relaxed, which I suppose is a good sign.
But take it from me that he doesn't look that way now.
I guess he's been set off again, but
what he expected happened, that SDS is planning a demonstration.
Correct.
So now
thank God there's some lead time. You see, we have till Wednesday. Well, we have till Wednesday, and then as you say, someone in the meantime has got to find out, I suppose what this really boils down to is someone has to find out what Metzger and Millett are up to, and someone has to be able to stand up there and say with some authority why the Chancellor didn't come on Monday, because that's going to get rehashed.
Well, I think the most important thing right now, maybe I'm wrong, but I think the most constructive thing that could happen, if it could possibly happen, would be for the Chancellor's credibility to be restored to at least two or three people. And the only way that I can see that happening is if the Chancellor is advised that his credibility is in danger, and this is why, and exactly where things stand, and then he sits down with these people and lays it on the line. Now, maybe I'm wrong.
No, look, I'm totally in agreement with you, Bill, because, in fact, I can take you into Professor Pine's office and show you where I put a note 1 week ago to the effect that the thing we had to fear most at this point was a lack of faith in the Chancellor and a feeling that he was about to sell us out on the part of Addison and Morrison. I believed it then, I believe it now.
Yeah, well, that has to be countered, I believe.
I think you're right.
And furthermore, it's going to...
taken to counter that, because, you see, this message was conveyed to Dean Albert, and Dean Albert sat down independently with Morrison and Addison and told him that he was not going to allow for a sellout. But now, you see, Morrison is talking himself into a position that maybe it doesn't matter whether or not Albert cares about a sellout,
right,
because Albert's powerless.
Right.
So there's some thing driving him along to believe that there's a sellout.
Well, I know that, but that's all by the by. The word
you're
has
right.
to come from the Chancellor.
Okay, I know. All right. You're right. That's where we're at. No, I was still trying to tell you my perception of the thing. As to what we do, I'm in total agreement with you as to why we're where we're at.
Yeah, I see.
Just for simply giving you some more background, I assure you that this danger was perceived at least a week ago, and steps were taken to do something about it.
Now there is another. The reason that I'm particularly concerned right now, and haven't been in the past, is that I do believe there's a danger now that GSA will line up on the wrong side.
Yeah.
As an organization, so far, like Bruce was very careful today, and I appreciate it.
Yeah.
To make it clear to the DI that he was there at the SDS meeting and an interested participant only as Bruce Morrison and not as a representative of GSA.
Good.
And he made that very clear, and that's a load off my mind.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, that question is going to come soon.
The nice thing
and people, the strange people, like Bruce Wood, are going to back Morrison.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Now, how do you get that?
Because Wood believes what Morrison is believing as well, essentially.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
I believe that's the case.
Woo.
No, whether the fact that Wood suddenly finds himself on the side of SDS will be enough to counter that inclination to believe Bruce, I don't know. But Wood also believes that the Chancellor blew it. Wood believes that the Chancellor blew it because of Millett and Metzger.
Yeah.
And while he's not up on the details of all this political stuff, I'm sure he's perfectly willing to believe that there is some kind of deal going.
This is the price we pay for allowing people like Millett to stay around, isn't it?
Yeah.
God, it really tells you something about bureaucracy. It is an ultimate. In the end, it's all confidence.
And that's why I say, I think it's very pressing that if we can possibly do it, and I know it's going to be hard with Bruce, the thing to do with Bruce would be for him to leave town for about 3 days and then come back.
You're right, but he can't do that.
He could do it, but I don't think he will.
He's not going to do it any more than I will.
Yeah, I said he will.
He
could do it.
I can tell you something about the psychology of this thing, and it is.